Get ready for a little surf and turf action on Midnight Run Through, a podcast miniseries devoted to celebrating the 1988 contemporary classic action buddy comedy Midnight Run, written by George Gallo and directed by Martin Brest. Co-hosted by me, One Heat Minute Productions' Blake Howard.
And me, Jen Johans from Watch with Jen.
Each week, we'll explore the film we first bonded over when we became friends in 2019 by surfing through an incredible roster of guests from journalists to novelists and beyond who love it as much as we do. Digging into Serrano's finances and Alonzo Mosley's FBI files, come with us on Midnight Run Through as we crisscross the United States with the characters played by Robert De Niro, Charles Grodin, John Ashton, Yaphet Kotto, Dennis Farina, Philip Baker Hall, Joe Pantoliano, and company on screen. Today, our guests are...
My name is Clay Keller. I am the host and producer of Screen Drafts podcast. And I love Midnight Run. That was like a Conan O'Brien needs a friend introduction. I feel ecstatic about Midnight Run.
My name is Brian Cogman. I'm a writer and producer of television and film. And I'm thrilled to be here to talk about one of my favorite movies, Midnight Run.
But before we go any further, let's kick things off with Jack Welch's Old Turf with the ultimate question.
Why were you so unpopular with the Chicago Police Department?
Today, Jen, we're so lucky. We've got the two emotions represented. We've got silence and we've got rage. Brian Cogman and Clay Keller talking to us about Midnight Run. Gentlemen, thank you so
much. Am I rage? Am I rage?
Both silence and rage. No,
Silence and rage.
Oh, we're both?
you're both silence and rage. I think if anyone has heard Brian's phenomenal suite of screen drafts, he can get into rage and he can
never
get into rage.
I am a measured and even keeled player.
Right. Mm-hmm. You have no opinions about how to define screwball comedy.
Oh, don't get me started. I don't curse.
Is Midnight Run a screwball comedy, Brian?
No.
If they were romantic.
No. If it were romantic. Yeah. Although it is
a little bit happened one night. A little bit.
It is a little it happened one night. And it, you know what? I kept watching it this morning. I rewatched some parts of it. I watched it last night and rewatched some parts of it this morning. And it does kind of have a definite, as Jen, as you said, like a 30s, 40s kind of not screwball comedy. I don't want Brian to scream at me because there's not a romantic angle, but the way that the characters keep running into each other constantly every 10 minutes throughout the movie has a very like kind of screwball-y, but like comedy of errors, but like out in the Southwest kind of thing where they just every time they turn a corner, they've run into every other character in the movie. I thought it's very like the coincidences rack up in a way that don't make you go like, okay, this stretches credulity. It's just kind of like you're delighted every time it amps up. You're like, oh, there, John Ashton's there again.
Well, it's great because they what's funny is a lot of times it's not coincidences. It's that like the screenplay is so deftly George Gallo's screenplay is so deftly structured that they all have their own reasons for being there, and they're all generally from the mobsters to the bounty hunters to the cops, they're all generally pretty good at their jobs. I mean, they make mistakes here and there, and they're outwitted
by each other.
They're
really good at finding people. All of them are extremely good at finding people.
They know what they're doing. You know, they're good at following the clues and, you know, to their logical conclusions.
I still can't get over how good, I mean, I know that everyone takes the mickey out of Marvin, right?
Marvin's pretty good.
Marvin knows what's up.
When Marvin calls the bank and fakes the name and says, you better cancel that car. I'm like, that's obviously the procedural element of this movie is something that I'm still in awe of as like a, you know, Manny Fava termite art guy, because I just don't think they showed the realist, like even just like picking locks, starting cars.
The process.
All the process porn in this movie is so fantastic. But I love that. He's just like, oh, yeah, no, you better cancel that card, or this has been used here, or this phone call here, and this person might be here. I love all of that because, there's no contrivance. It's so fun. Like when Jack and the Duke are together with Moron number one and two in the alleyway, and then Marvin rolls up. Like, that's so joyful. It's like, yes, yeah. Marvin's here. It's like, I can't wait. It's so good. Yeah. It's, and of course Marvin's there, and none of the 4,000 FBI agents led by Alonzo Mosley are right.
there. Because they are the least good at their jobs, the the feds. Yeah, I love that Marvin has Jack's credit card just in case he needs to cancel it.
Yes.
Like, it's like, that's great. He's like, this is his rival. He only pulls it out for
and he's got it memorized.
Yeah. It's fucking great.
It's got De Niro's credit card number memorized.
Does he? I thought he had it written down on a little pad.
Oh, does he? It,
oh, just, oh, no, it might be in his notebook. But yeah, he knows his full name.
He's got a little notebook and he's, yeah, because he's pretty good at his job, but he's not as good as Jack. Like, so in at certain points, like there's little details. I mean, we're jumping around here, but little details where, you know, when Joe Pantoliano's character brings Marvin onto the job, and he's like, well, you've heard of the Duke, right? And Marvin's like, no, I don't know who he is, because he doesn't read the paper. He doesn't keep up on things the way, you know, a better bounty hunter, Jack Walsh, does. So there's just great little consistent kind of character details throughout with every character in this movie. It's one of the many reasons it's so great.
When you get back to it, Clay, as you were describing, you know, you watched the movie last night and then you watched those, you were cherry picking some scenes this morning before we talked. What are those scenes that you have to go back and watch again? Like, once you're reminded of how great Midnight Run is, like, what are those scenes that you're like, oh my God, I have to watch that again because I can't believe how good it is.
Well, the thing I wanted to revisit specifically was the airport scene at the end, where De Niro and Farina finally have their scene together. Mm-hmm.
Jack, long time no see.
Long time no see.
Yeah, I see you're still spending all your money on clothes. Huh?
Well, you know.
Listen, while you're in town,
if you want to go see a show, you want a free meal or something like that, you just let me know, all right? On me.
This type of guy I am.
You're a real sport.
Yeah.
Just give him the discs.
Where's your mother?
She's all right.
Daughter's getting big, everything growing up. You know, I was thinking maybe if we would have done business way back when, you wouldn't look like a guy with a fucking cup in your hand.
Trying to make a living.
Yeah. Listen, Jack, you got those discs, or did you lose them like you lost your job?
Give him the discs, Walsh.
Well, I see you, but I don't see the Duke.
We'll worry about him in a minute.
Oh, we got to worry about him now. Let me tell you something, Jimmy. This isn't the reunion. If I don't see the Duke in about 5 seconds, I'm walking.
You know, you're still way too serious, really. Listen, why don't you just hand over the tapes? We'll take a walk. We'll go get the guy together. What do you say?
Fuck you. I'll see you at the arraignment.
Hey, Jack. Jack. Hey.
Where the hell is he going?
You win, all right?
What?
You won. What do you want me to do? Yell it all over this fucking airport?
Where is he?
He's on his way.
You know, I said no goons.
Never mind him. You're going to get what you want, and I just tell you that.
This thing is going to give me a heart attack before it's all over. I know I'm going to get a heart attack.
Since we have this moment to share together, there's something I've been meaning to ask you. Doesn't it bother you that another copper is fucking your wife? You know they made this guy a captain? Can you imagine that? Go figure it out. Made him a captain.
Because I just, and it's this, Farina had not, what, he started acting with Thief? Is that right? Or he had only been
Michael
around
Mann,
for...
Yeah, Michael Mann
brought
him in.
Because he was a cop.
Chicago cop and partner to Charlie Adamson, the lead detective who killed the real Neil McCauley, who's like, and actually, and was the inciting incident, if you like, of Michael Mann's, you know, 30 to 40 year odyssey of Heat. He was his partner, and he plays just a a hood, just like in all of Thief. It's cops play crooks and criminals play cops in that movie. So yeah, that's like his first thing. And then his next big thing after that is obviously Manhunter, where he plays Jack Crawford. So like, it's pretty,
he had quite an ascension there, coming off of not being an actor. And then to hear like 3-4 years later, going toe to toe with De Niro. And I just think those guys are, and you know, I'm sure Blake, you and Jen, I know this is, you know, kind of your wheelhouse too, this type of actor, but we just don't have these guys anymore at all. Right. We don't have these guys who you just look, kind of, we can just look at their faces, mm-hmm. but they open their mouths and you're like, this is a guy who came from a place. This is a guy.
Yes.
Yep.
Came from Chicago. He is from the streets of Chicago. You look at De Niro, you're like, this guy is, you know, fucking New York City through and through. Mm-hmm. And they're just throwing these energies at each other. And it's just so potent. And neither of them are, I mean, Farina's having a little fun with this role. He's gesticulating. He's kind of leaning into it.
Yeah, yeah.
De Niro, as ever, at least at this era, like, the fun is that he is just, he's playing it. I mean, he is underplaying it and letting little bits crack through, which is what Grodin's doing too, which is what makes it so grounded and keeps it, you know, believable drama. And it's not kind of a kooky movie, even though so many crazy things happen. But that scene with Farina and De Niro is just so, it's just crackling. And I just love, there's like menace. Farina does menace so well. And De Niro is just, you know, playing it cool. But the whole thing is so, they keep cutting to Alonzo and he's freaking out. And then John Ashton comes in, you've got all these moving pieces and you're wondering how it's gonna, you know, explode. But that's a great sequence. That's probably like, I love Grodin. I love De Niro together. Everybody's favorite scenes, the con with the counterfeit 20s, the litmus test scene and all that stuff. And I love the end too. The last like 20 minutes, the last scene at the airport where he lets him go and he gives him the money. All that stuff is just really, really charming. But that scene with Farina, I think, is probably my favorite scene in the movie.
I love that there isn't like a physical confrontation. He doesn't chase him down and shoot him, or what you would expect in the 80s. Like, he walks over, you're under arrest. And you know, you weren't expecting that necessarily. I love that.
Yeah, and it's a great line delivery. And I love the way that scene is blocked too, because my common complaint with movies now is that directors never do blocking and every scene of dialogue is just people sitting or standing in one place and just cutting back and forth, doing over the shoulders, and drives me nuts. But this one, it's so great because these are two guys, they're meeting in this public place and they're trying not to draw attention to each other. So they have this intense conversation, completely still, trying to not look conspicuous, surrounded by people. And we've got like the god's eye up with the FBI guys and Alonzo and looking down. I think it's the perfect use of stationary blocking in this scene, which is something I generally am really sick of. But, and because the whole movie we've been moving and moving and moving and moving and moving. True. And the big climactic like suspense scene is the two guys standing completely still, trying not to move.
And they've been building up. They've been building up this backstory about Serrano and Walsh, you know, so beautifully laid out. Like all the reveals about when you find out, you know, the nature of De Niro's history with him. So there's a great emotional, you know, tension in this scene as well. And then the fact that at this point he really genuinely cares about Mardukas and is trying to save his life. You know, so it's a brilliantly staged sequence and all of that great character work that's been just so deftly, you know, doled out throughout the movie just kind of all comes to a head, so that you don't need a big histrionic action sequence, because you know you care so much about these characters that it's enough to hang the climax of your movie on. And you had the big explosion with the helicopter, like you got that already.
Jack.
You
know? He killed a helicopter with like a 9mm. Like we've had crazy action scenes throughout the middle of the movie.
We used to be a culture. Yeah. You know, we used to be a culture.
We used to be a culture because you know that the most exciting thing that can happen in this movie is that you, in a satisfying way, bring these characters all together finally and have a conclusion to these character arcs. It's not going to be like, how do we one up in a, like a, in terms of explosions. And I misspoke earlier that all of the characters run into each other in 15 minutes. That's not true. It's this great build of two pairs of, there's like four or five kind of parallel groups going at the whole time. And they will be like, two of them run into each other or three of them run into each other. Then the pairing switch. And then Alonzo runs into John Ashton, and then John Ashton later runs into, and this is the first time. Every single thread
that everything's there.
Comes together. And it's thrillingly constructed. As Brian said, the screenplay is phenomenal.
Yeah. If I were ever to teach screenwriting, this would be the screenplay I would teach. I think it is a perfect screenplay. And I know that there was probably a degree of improvisation baked in with the two handers between Gruden and De Niro. And I think Gallo has said as much, so maybe not every single piece of dialogue is exactly from Gallo, but the construction of it, the little, I mean, from the very first scene, De Niro's trying to, you know, see if his watch is keeping time. Like all of these beautiful little details that are seeded throughout. And it's so, and this speaks to, you know, Martin Brest and his amazing ability as a director. It's all so beautifully constructed, and you don't notice the construction at all. It feels effortless, which is probably why, you know, this movie's always been, I think, well regarded, but I think it's a movie that makes its genius look so easy that people forget that it's actually a masterpiece. I mean, it's my third favorite movie of all time. I've probably seen it. Yeah. I mean, this is the movie along with The Adventures of Robin Hood with Errol Flynn, which I've talked about many times on podcasts. Those are two movies I will throw on and my mood will lift. That's it. From the second the little comes on,
the score in the history of movies,
I am done. I'm going to be happy. And you know, this is a in many ways a thriller with a lot of dark shit in it, but it's so it's balance, its tone is so beautifully calibrated. It's never too goofy, but also never too scary and too violent. Like, it just hits that sweet spot that very, very, very few movies in general do anymore.
Well, not comedies, certainly.
Certainly not comedies.
No. There was a point in the early 2000s where from that point on, no character in any comedy seemed like a real human being ever again.
Right.
No.
100%.
And 100%. That's what I love about this. I mean, I think this movie is probably the best example of this thing that I love from the 70s and 80s, and is a comedy doesn't mean goofy non sequiturs and constant like wacky lines and the silliest stuff you can come up with all the time. It just is about that tone, like you said, Brian. It is a drama as a baseline, and then the situations and the things are just dialed up a little bit, and it's the music and it's the performances and it's the tone of it, because this movie has almost no like jokes really. There are very funny situations,
like, it's more that how people are reacting to certain situations, like you know, a scene that Jen and I love, like when Alonzo first meets Jack and Jack just completely ignores every word that is coming out of his mouth, and he just puts his sunglasses on and starts looking around. Like that's hilarious, because he's like, oh, it's so much funnier if I just ignore you. Like, I'm not intimidated by you at all. And I think that pairs perfectly with the scene that you talked about earlier, Clay. Your favorite scene in the airport is like, it's like you've got a guy who's like really blustery and like this sort of faux intimidating. And then you've got someone like Dennis Farina, who you actually can feel the electricity coming out of your television or your projector, where you're like, oh, he just has to whisper to you and you think I'm going to die. You're like, oh, he's going to kill me, or he's going to.
And
do
right
something.
Before that scene, I mean,
they set this up
where Farina throughout the movie, he's like gesticulating like, yeah, give me this guy. And you're like, okay, he's kind of a cartoon. Yeah. They want an over the top, you know, mob antagonist.
Yeah.
And then he sits down in the car, like he said, and he stares, looks him in the face, and is like, I'm gonna go home and I'm gonna kill your wife. You're like, oh
yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So now there's like, there's the stakes got upped a little bit here. This is the real thing.
You understand at this point just what everybody's up against and why why Grodin has been frightened for his life. It's one thing to be like, well, I'll be killed in prison, but you're absolutely right, that scene right when it needs to, that's the thing, all of these scenes, everything is accomplished exactly when the movie needs it to be accomplished. It's so every time I watch it, I just marvel at that, you know.
Not too soon, because if Farina had looked Grodin in the face and said, when I get you, I'm going to kill you and I'm going to kill your wife at the beginning of the movie, I think it would have put a little bit of a pall over the whole thing. Mm-hmm. It would have made the jauntiness feel in conflict with the stakes instead of like feeding each other really nicely.
Oh, or the backstory with the drugs being planted at De Niro's and why he was chased out of Chicago. Like, if they would have established that right away, like, he's a bounty hunter because he was a cop and this happened, it would be a whole different movie. Yeah.
Why are you so unpopular with the Chicago Police Department? I've got to get a t-shirt that says that. Why are you so popular with the Chicago Police Department? And what's great about the way all of this exposition is doled out, too, like, it's amazing because you get all of this, most of this information you get just enough at the beginning to know that he was once a cop and he wants out. But you really get most of the information when Mardukas gets it in the course of them getting to know each other and talking to each other about themselves. And again, all of this is built into character because the Duke is a fascinating character who also you learn so much about him and actually how smart he is. He seems like this hapless buffoon until you realize, oh, he faked the fear of flying.
The litmus configuration when he
all of that. Like he's a genius. And this is how you realize he stayed a step ahead of all these guys. But in terms of getting the information out of De Niro about his past, Mardukas and Grodin are established as first kind of deeply empathetic and curious people, but also there might be a little bit of method to his madness. Like, he's asking him questions about himself, he's sensing a vulnerability in Jack because it's a way to get Jack close to him and a way to get Jack to like him so that Jack lets his guard down and he can maybe get away. But yet he also is an empathetic person who truly does begin to care about him,
right?
So it's very deft, and it's never it's never spelled out for you what he's doing. And it's the kind of thing that you only kind of notice in some cases in multiple viewings. But and it also is a way for the screenwriter to get the backstory out in a way that feels organic.
You know what I'm noticing, Brian? You've got this Midnight Run poster over your left shoulder there.
Indeed.
Blake has this Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1 poster behind his head there. These are the same movie.
Oh, sure.
There is a lot of Midnight Run in Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning.
Absolutely.
The structure is very similar. Like, Shea Whigham is Mosley. It really is them.
Oh my gosh.
Constantly in airports or running around with near misses and escapes. And Tom Cruise is trying to stop
him.
She's constantly trying to escape from him.
Isai Morales was dressed by Dennis Farina's costume designer.
Right. Sure.
John Ashton is the entity.
Yeah, John, the entity sees all, knows all. That's funny. Well, a lot of movies, I mean, have chased this one. And they've never gotten it right. I mean, to what we were talking about earlier about recent, about modern day comedies. I mean, if someone were to try to remake this today, or movies that come out and they say, well, our biggest template was Midnight Run, and then you watch the movie and you think, how so?
That's the greatest flaw. It's whenever it's, I'm starting to hear it in a lot of, especially in new movies. As soon as someone's like, the biggest trap, people are like, our biggest influence was Heat, and I'm like, oh great. I'm like, oh, fantastic. I can't wait to see how you misinterpreted Heat again. Right. I can't wait. I'm sure it's not going to take 3 or 4 stars off of your ultimate score.
Yeah. And that's how this is ultimately, like, Mardukas now would be an over the top buffoon.
Yes.
He would be Zach Galifianakis in that movie with Robert Downey Jr. Where they have a road trip.
Oh, there it is.
Oh, Due Date.
Due Date.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Which I'm sure they thought Midnight Run was a big influence.
Yeah. Midnight Run and Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. And that's the thing. I know we're not talking about Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, although I imagine it'll come up in more than one of these conversations you guys have, Blake and Jen.
Yes.
Because this is the year after two years after before. This is 88. I always this thought this was earlier. This is 88. Isn't Planes, Trains 87?
I thought so.
I think.
Oh, it could be. Oh, you're right. Maybe you're right. Yeah. Yeah, you're right.
80,
you're
right. But even there where John Candy is playing it, both Martin and Candy are playing it much bigger than De Niro and Grodin are in this movie. Even then, but compared to today's standards, those guys look like the most believable, authentic human beings you've ever seen in a movie.
Yeah.
And there is something to that. And I just, you know, I do. I love. I was reading, and by I was reading, I mean, I scrolled the IMDb trivia quickly. So, you know, take this with a pound of salt. But that Yafikoto didn't know, and maybe this is just because of how his scenes are played, how he played his character. He didn't really know if it was a comedy or a drama at any point. And his great quote, and since I hope this is a true quote from the IMDb trivia that they pulled from somewhere, but that he thought it was a drama with some comedy. And then we saw the movie, the stuff he thought was going to be funny was funny. And stuff he thought was going to be dramatic was even funnier than the funny stuff. and that's the way, and he plays it that way. And I think that really is a great flavor for the movie. I mean, brings a great energy to this, but I love that there's no jokes, there's no one-liners, there's no over-the-top absurdly comedic. Like I said, there's no scene where they have to go in and, like, you know what, this is 88, so like Grodin has to be in, you know, dressed like a woman or something. Like there's like super dialed up crazy shit. It's all grounded in the setting too. I love how the way they use the Southwest is so great.
Location work throughout this thing is phenomenal.
Look, it's such a place you're not expecting to see De Niro. I like they take De Niro, who is the epitome of, you know, I guess I said earlier, from, like, he didn't see the sun until he was, you know, 30 years old. He was always in the shadow of a fucking building. And now he's out in the desert. And I don't know his filmography of in the mid 80s off the top of my head, but I feel like it was unusual to see him not in an urban situation.
Oh, it absolutely was. And it absolutely would have been in the 80s. And it would have been unusual to see him in something. I mean, he went on to make a ton of comedies.
Right.
Post Meet the Parents, but very rare to see him in something this comparatively lighthearted.
Yeah, he was making The Mission and Falling in Love and a little heavier stuff. Yeah, sort
of comedy and, you know, Goodfellas Jackknife just the next year. Yeah,
yeah.
So this, but what's so funny is, and this is something I really noticed because, you know, when we were emailing about this, about doing this, like, I think you mentioned, like, maybe, you know, maybe think about who your favorite character is. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to watch this and think, who's my favorite character? And by the end, I was like, well, my favorite character is Jack Walsh. I think Jack Walsh is a movie hero for the ages. And that performance, again, he it's so low key and so seemingly effortless that you don't quite understand kind of how brilliant. I think it's one of De Niro's best performances in general. It's because he keeps it kind of lighthearted. A lot of the source of the comedy is Jack. Like it's not just Grodin being silly and him rolling his eyes and playing straight man. Like, Jack keeps things light. Jack's fucking with the cops. He gets the badge and he does that thing where he flashes the camera. Like, he's ultimate. Like, you know, he's got problems and he's unhappy in his work, but he's also kind of, it reminded me a lot of Paul Newman's performance in the noir movie Harper.
Love
a little
Hopper.
Bit.
You know, where it's like, he keeps it light. He tries to stay happy in his work. He's good at his job and he's creative and he's, you know, so the whole movie and indeed I think the whole cast, and I'm sure Brest when he was, you know, compiling it, I think he takes a lot of cues from De Niro's kind of bearing in the movie, if that makes sense.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because there's a version of this where he's just way too grumpy and hard edged, or they give him a backstory that's more tragic that overwhelms the movie.
They
absolutely would do today. Yeah. Well, that actually reminds me of my favorite scene and my favorite scene in the movie, and it's the one that pops in my head when I think about what a brilliant screenplay this is the scene where they go back to the family home.
Yeah.
Yes.
That scene, and I think Are You in the Eighth Grade is one of my favorite De Niro acting. That is up there with anything he did in Raging Bull.
Yeah.
That's the only thing he says to her. He says, "Are you in the eighth grade?" And they just look at each other for about 15, 20 seconds while all the mom's in there. They don't try to talk because what else? What are you going to say? There's nothing to say. It's, and the little girl, Danielle, I think her name is Danielle Dublo or something, or Dubla, who I don't think has did that many other movies. She's incredible, but it's such a beautiful scene in that it's not overwritten. It's not full of tears. And it feels absolutely perfect and authentic. And also Wendy Phillips, who plays his ex-wife, that scene could have gone really maudlin or it's just sad enough.
It's all in his,
and it really informs
pitch. It's all in his pitch.
It's all in his pitch. Yeah.
I love it.
Everyone looks real. The house looks real. It isn't overdone. Yep. They don't have like a sitcom wife style babe playing the, I mean, she's perfect.
Right.
She looks like a woman you'd be friends with. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Like a woman, you know. Yeah. Yep.
Everybody in this movie looks like people you would know.
Yeah.
Like everybody. It's amazing. Yep.
Well, and that's just a, you know, that's great. That's great casting. But I also just think that's the era is they just, again, up until the 90s, they wanted authenticity to some extent in movies. Mm-hmm. I love the 90s era as well, but
Clay's fan of contemporary Marvel cinema. He's just out he loves it all.
But like waitress in the diner who tells him about chorizo and toast. She's just,
what's chorizo?
Yeah, it's a Spanish style sausage.
That might be my favorite Grodin. My favorite Grodin thing is the teeth, is the line delivery of he asks how much the coffee is, asks how much the tea is.
Yeah, how much is the coffee? 53 cents.
And then he thinks for 10 seconds.
What can I do for you, boys?
Coffee, please. How much is the coffee?
It's 53 cents.
How much is tea?
53 cents. Okay, and our breakfast special today is chorizo and eggs.
Chorizo and eggs?
Chorizo and eggs.
What is that, please?
It's a Mexican sausage mixed in with scrambled eggs, and it comes with hash browns and toast.
I won't be having that. Thank you.
Like, it's just... But that's what's so nimble about... Brian, back to what you were saying about the calibration of De Niro's performance. And I think that's what's so brilliant about... Grodin too, because you could have had somebody like a Robin Williams or something at this time in this role who is going to be kooky and then force De Niro to be the straight man at all times. And Grodin is so fun because he said he is a little silly, but not really. Like every time I watch this movie, I remember how not dialed up and how not kooky and quirky Grodin is. Like he there's half the scenes he's the straight man and De Niro is the one who's kind of like spinning out, and I love that they can trade that power in the scenes back and forth throughout this movie because it keeps the audience on their toes, but it also just makes it more interesting and less predictable. And Grodin's performance is fascinating to me in this movie. And I don't know if it's just a thing where just that's kind of how Grodin is, and it was just brilliant casting, like they just cast the absolute right guy for to make this a unique movie, or if he was putting a lot of work into it. I don't know, but it's Grodin in this movie is kind of a singular. I don't know if I've ever seen a guy like I've seen a guy and De Niro's played him, but I've seen a guy like Jack Walsh in other movies, and De Niro does it really, really, really well and in an interesting different way. I don't know if I've ever seen a guy.
No, he's
in another movie.
Mardukas is one of the most unusual, unique characters.
He had to keep auditioning and keep doing improv with De Niro, like in rooms, just to see how they played off of each other. But I love what you guys were saying about De Niro and the levity and not overplaying it. I think a lot of that might also come from coming after Beverly Hills Cop, because I'm a huge fan of that movie. I actually prefer it to 48 Hours. I'm sorry. But I love the film. And when you watch it, you might remember it as, oh, it's just Eddie Murphy being hilarious in every scene. And he is hilarious, but he's a damn good cop, and he's on top of things. And he's very serious and very intense in moments. And sometimes the stuff he's saying doesn't seem like it would be a joke, but it's the way he punches it. And so I think that's Martin Brest, and also maybe what he wanted with De Niro a little bit. De Niro is not Eddie Murphy. He's not going for those types of scenes, you know, like, you know, Michael Jackson can sit on top of the world. We don't have those kind of monologues in this movie. Right. But a little bit of that, like, you know, procedure porn was also in Beverly Hills Cop, and just somebody being quick and good at their job. Yeah,
I love it when people are good at their job and doing a job in movies. I don't know why. Yeah. I find that I don't know why I love that so much, but I love this idea that he's a former cop, he's got his contacts, you know, in the local precincts, like there's a procedure to what he does, and that's just so fun to see, you know, and you don't see that sort of thing anymore. It's usually elided, you know.
It's yeah. The phenomena that I call chefs do that from A Long Kiss Goodnight. Chefs do that. It's just a joyful thing that someone doing something awesome in a movie, you're like, yep, that's good. That's really, chefs do that. It's great. But no, Clay, just to jump back onto Grodin, working on another project that is kicking around in the One Heat Minute Productions sort of whiteboard at the moment, factory, if you like, is a rule that I have now, which is if you can act brilliantly across from a Muppet, you're all time.
Yeah.
Oh, sure. And he's the greatest.
And Grodin and Miss Piggy.
Ugh.
I'm like,
chemistry for days.
He's so funny, and it's just like, that's where
he,
I think,
and he plays it so straight in that movie,
and just so, like, and so, like,
Miss Piggy,
alluring.
don't put a door between us.
Forgive me, Miss Piggy. Yeah.
Forgive me, Miss Piggy.
It's just like, you are so much better than just the average actor at that point when you can be that serious, that it's like everything that he does in this movie, it is no surprise. It's a level of genius that you're just like, oh, he's operating on a whole new level.
We'll be back after this quick break.
That one segment where they're on the, at that point, I think they're on a bus together, is very clearly, it's the most very clearly, like, they just told Grodin to just keep talking and improv, and you see De Niro break, actually.
Yes.
He starts laughing and goes, this fucking guy, like, you see, yes. That's the one time where I'm like, I think that's De Niro, the human actor breaking, but then just, you know, but recovering and using it in the scene. It must have just been so much fun.
Mm-hmm.
The two of them clearly had a lot of fun together, even with all the crazy stuff that they put them through.
Yeah.
But yeah, and so it like most buddy comedies. Most buddy comedies, you sort of, the formula works so well that a lot of buddy comedies don't do the actual work of convincingly making them buddies by the end.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And even this at the end, like, sure, they're buddies. They're not best friends. They're not going to ever see each other again.
No.
You know, they've had this experience together. And that final scene where he gives them the money is just
kind of moving.
Very moving. To me, I mean, it's like,
and the movie's so smart because he gives him the money and it's so beautiful and so sweet, and De Niro walks out to a cabbie and goes, got change for 100.
change for a thousand.
$1,000. Like, get out of here. He's like,
well it looks like I'm walking is
yes,
but that the best last one, well, that's my favorite last line of any movie. I mean,
but also this is actually, I mean, it's so sweet and so funny, as Blake was saying. This is actually the darkest ending of maybe any movie I've ever seen, having to try and walk out of Los Angeles International Airport to somewhere. It's like walking into Mordor. That's a fate worse than death.
I can agree. As an Australian who his most recent international trip, I had to walk even from domestic international terminal to domestic. I was like, this is Mordor right now. There's lots of work happening there.
And this was 1988. It was even worse in that area back then.
Probably, no, it's bad news.
Now. Yeah, and it's funny you mentioned, I mean, this is like the, you know, 200th time I've watched this, but I watched it again yesterday. And for the first time, I thought to myself, well, you know, this ending, it's a happy ending, but there's a bit of melancholy to it. I mean, you know, Mardukas is always going to be on the run.
He's a fugitive still.
He's a fugitive. Serrano is in prison, but very much still a danger to both Duke and Walsh. I mean, he says, like, they'll catch up again sometime. Like, that's not over between them. Mm-mm. You know, and as the Duke says, restaurants are a very risky investment, and most of them go under. So what's nice about the ending is it wraps everything up and you feel good at the end, but it's not an ending that it's still got a little bit of that melancholy and darkness and uncertainty that sort of, you know, makes the movie feel like it has real stakes, you know?
Right. They needed to leave open plot doors for the three straight to video Christopher McDonald films,
which I've never seen either.
I like Christopher McDonald.
I like him too, but I'm not.
First
I don't know.
One.
I don't want to do it.
An experience. See,
this is actually the benefit of Australia not having access to things, is that I don't think they ever came. If they came to Australia, they were shown on broadcast television at midnight. And I think I would have to find someone who has a VHS tape that probably still had the ads in the recording if I was going to find it in Australia.
I mean, they're on DVD.
Yeah,
they're on
DVD. I bought the DVD that had all of them when we were
sorry, Blake,
them.
You can watch these.
Yeah. Oh, God damn it, Clay.
I will be sending you it to Australia. It. No, I'm just kidding.
There you go. Yeah.
I have his address. Yeah.
I think they were meant to maybe springboard a series.
Because two of them are the same year. No, they're all three of them are the same year.
Yeah. Because back then what they would
do is they made them in a week.
Yeah. I mean, you're right, though, Jen. They would just go and they'd shoot these things kind of as one big production and kind of dole them out. You know, Clay, it's like that Ipcris file pair of sequels.
Oh, the TV movies. Yeah.
The TV movies with Michael Caine as, what's his face? Harry Palmer. They would have just made those back to back.
Back to back.
You know, so that's probably what they did here. But I've never been able to bring myself to do it. There might have been a sequel you could have done bringing the two of them back that might have worked. But I'm so glad there isn't. I don't think there's any reason to.
Although I do love the titles of the Midnight Run sequels. You've got Another Midnight Run, which is like Another 48 Hours.
Like Another 48 Hours. Which that then one I think Gallo did write.
What?
I think Gallo did write Another Midnight Run. I could be wrong.
Oh, he wrote it.
I think he did write it.
I thought you meant he did write. As opposed to doing wrong.
Oh, no, I never. I was
Gallo
never
did write. Then there's here's where we get into some like puns, and this is what I like: Midnight Run for Your Life.
No, no.
And Midnight Run Around.
Nope. Well, there it is.
No. All right.
There are no puns in Midnight Run.
But just back really quickly to the Harry Palmers. At least with the Ipcress file sequels, one of them, Funeral in Blim, was directed by Guy Hamilton, who did.
Oh yeah, well those sequels. There are great.
They're really weird. And the third one, Billion Dollar Brain, is directed by Ken Russell.
Oh yeah,
it's a weird movie. Really
Clay and Ryan on their Screen Drafts Patreon did a whole episode about these movies Harry Palmer movies, which are worth a listen.
Ipcress File is a unheralded classic, I think.
Yeah,
agree.
And Fear in Berlin is great, and Billion Dollar Brain is wacky. Billion Dollar Brain is my favorite James Bond movie of the late 60s.
What was nice about Midnight Run was it was successful, but not so successful that it had to have a sequel.
Yes.
Yeah.
To ruin it. Because I think it was a moderate success. Like, it probably made its money back.
Well,
I
took a look, and it did okay. In the domestic, it only grossed like 7 or 8 million more than its budget. This thing is an expensive movie, though. They are out on location for this entire movie, blowing up helicopters, doing car chases, scenes with 40 extras as policemen, and cop cars and descending. And like, this is they're going to Vegas. There's a lot of shit going on in this movie.
And they had to shoot the river sequence in New Zealand because at the time of year they were shooting, it was too cold in the States, but apparently it was still freezing there, like a very, very difficult shoot. I gather it was a movie that found its cult its following mainly in the VHS DVD. I mean, that's when I would have first seen it. I would have first seen it on VHS probably when I was in high school.
Considering the TV stuff suddenly is 6 years later,
like
that does feel like it in the early 90s, it became kind of
someone's
a
like, this is making money.
Yeah.
This is making money on video. Like, okay, it's time.
Or
to...
HBO, maybe it was people were loving it on HBO or something.
But not enough money to try to get De Niro and Grodin back for a proper sequel. Enough to make some TV.
Grodin was making that Beethoven money. By
he was in Beethoven.
His quote, after Beethoven, his quote probably tripled.
Yeah, he never really, Grodin didn't have a lot of opportunities to be the front and center of a movie the way that he is here, which is too bad.
I think he's too specific. He's too specific. He's too odd. Like, but what his big movies after this, he plays the like beset upon angry father. Like
Clifford.
He does Beethoven, where he's just like an exasperated dad.
Yeah.
Which is maybe those are his two... his two lanes. He can either be very exasperated, or when he plays like a normal guy, he's just got that Grodin weirdness that makes him so fun and odd, but not like a good, you know, central holding the movie together kind of figure.
Yeah
Inside you there are two
he's
wolves.
Too slippery. He's too hard to pin.
Inside you there are two wolves: exasperated dad and just deeply weird attracted to Miss Piggy. Like
that's it's true. Like, I mean,
that's
even
me,
his younger
actually.
Leading man stuff, that's like Heartbreak Kid and you know, is the heavy in that crazy 70s King Kong. He's like the Carl Denham character in that.
But weird. He's a weird,
very weird,
in that movie.
Yeah.
So I Married an Axe Murderer. He didn't want his car commandeered, which I love.
Right.
This is official police business. I would like to commandeer this vehicle.
No.
What do you mean, no?
I happen to know for a fact that you don't have the right to commandeer my vehicle.
Please, can I commandeer this vehicle?
No.
You're just not going to bend on this commandeering thing, are you?
No. Would you mind not doing that?
This bothers you?
No, it's one of my favorite things.
Yeah, he'll pop up a lot. He popped up in Dave as the accountant that balances the budget, like the small town accountant.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right.
Balances the national budget in like a day. You know, like you do. But yeah, the whole cast, top to bottom, is just, I mean, all these amazing, as we said, like the everyone down to the waitresses and the clerks at the train offices, to the supporting cast, you know, Joe Pantoliano and Yaphet Kotto, that wonderful actors who play the Yaphet Kotto's two partners, his underlings.
Oh, those guys are fabulous.
They're just great. And as you say, they aren't doing jokes. They're just giving Alonzo the information at the exact wrong time and just not quite delivering it right, to the point where it annoys him. You know, it's like, oh, that must mean Jack Walsh has your identification, sir.
Yeah.
You know, he just looks at him like, yeah, I know, asshole.
Yeah, it's something that everyone has just said like 10 times. Thanks.
Yeah, it's so dry. It's also just, and again, they look like these are the guys doing that job. They're costumed like the guys doing that job. They're not in expensive suits. They're in, you know, mid-level expensive suits.
Yeah.
And just trusting everybody in every level of getting this movie made, trusting that a moment like that will be funny.
On its own,
on the day, because it does, like the quote from Yaphet Kotto, this screenplay probably doesn't read, if you're just sitting reading it, an executive gets it and reads it,
right,
it's not making them laugh out loud, like there it is not obviously funny on the page. It is just knowing that when you get these guys in there, you get Brest directing it, if this is going to be a funny movie. I think again today, executives say, where are the jokes? And then that moment goes from, I think he has your identification, played very straight, and Yaphet Kotto just relying totally on reaction based out of what you know of this character from this movie. It's just, you're just imagining what he's thinking, and you're like, that's funny. And now it'd be I think he has your identification. It'd be like, oh, you think? And be like, well, yeah. And it would turn into this little like mantery thing. Yep. And this movie just lets the characters kind of the audience gets so much comedy out of just, yeah, again, knowing what the character must be thinking, reacting to something, because they such rich characters.
Even him saying, "I'm Mosley," like on a page.
Right, right.
Yeah.
It's
I'm Mosley.
It's exactly that. It's the panic. I'm Mosley. Like it's finally happening, and you're like, "Oh my god, this movie!"
And that's
so
the
funny,
and the great funny for me. The funny, even funnier part of that bit is the train valet guy. Because that guy knows something that this cop doesn't know, and he's excited to tell him, like, you know, his real name's Mosley. Which is just a lovely little beat. Like, there's this guy, and nothing exciting happens to him on this train, and this really exciting thing happens. And he's like, "Ooh, I get to tell him about the real identity of Jack Walsh." and that's throughout. Just all these little, and these little subplots that are just really rewarding every time you watch. Like, I can't remember the character's name, even though I've watched it 1,000 times, but Joe Pantoliano's sidekick, played by Jack Kehoe.
Jerry
in The Office, who's informing for the mob.
Talk about a real person. Yeah,
right?
Like,
yeah. He's that guy. He's that poor son of a bitch who's answering phones at the bail bonds and you know, let's go out and get donuts. He's great.
Those
he's
guys shower 3 times a year, you know? Yeah. Like they just
they're there 24/7. You know, and everyone's smoking. That's the thing. It really dates it.
There
for
might
you.
Be more smoking in this movie than any. And they've got the running joke about the cigarettes. Actually,
yes.
That might be the best joke in the movie.
Watch out for this.
Watch out for this guy, Jack.
Yeah. Get careful. Watch out for your cigarettes around this guy or something.
Yeah.
The thing that Marvin has come away with from this entire experience is how angry he is at Mosley for stealing his cigarette.
Yeah. Yeah.
But there's so much smoking in this movie. It's
so much smoking. I forgot you could just smoking at the counter when you're getting your fucking plane ticket.
I think De Niro is lighting a cigarette at the beginning of 50% of the scenes.
Yeah, it's incredible. And the other thing I love, and this is as someone who wrote quite a bit of it for many years, I love when profanity is so well used in dialogue.
Mm.
Like the profanity, and I know that's a strange thing to say, but the use of son of a bitch and fuck and all of the great curses available to all of us it's like poetry in this thing. Like some of the Dennis Farina lines. I wrote down my favorite. There's so many, but
some fucking thing
that's one of them, which is great. Sydney, sit down, relax, have a sandwich, drink a glass of milk, do some fucking thing, will you? That's great. And then earlier on when he says, "You and that other dummy better start getting more personally involved in your work, or I'm going to stab you through the heart with a fucking pencil." Fantastic. Just
if she perfect amount of beats. It's like rhythm.
Yeah.
You can tap out on a desk, which is what I used to do when I was writing scripts. Yeah,
it's the closest. One of my favorite comedians of all time, the amazing Billy Connolly.
Sure, of course.
Great Scottish comedian has that rhythm. Where he puts a fuck, it's just perfect. Like the profanity is so well timed that exactly as you said, Jen, it is like it's the bang on the drum.
Staccato.
That's like it's bang. Mm-hmm. He just gets it every time. It's the perfect deployment, and that's where it's like it's not overly profane, but it's very funny. Like with a fucking pencil and like
pencil.
Dennis Farina.
Boom.
Bang. It's just...
Then later on, he says, "Sydney, shut the fuck up. Shut the fuck up. I'm gonna bury this phone in your head."
And with that immaculate Chicago accent,
I love.
And you get De Niro,
and it's Philip Baker Hall too.
Oh, Philip Baker Hall in
perfect.
The prequel to Hard Eight.
Yeah,
right
here,
right,
which
exactly.
I think Paul Thomas Anderson has. I don't think he said like, "Oh yeah, it's a prequel," but he has. I think kind of been like, "Yeah, you got me.
Yeah.
It's Sydney." Is
Sydney. Oh, he absolutely said Sydney's name for Sydney. Yes,
which I think is fantastic.
Amazing.
I absolutely love this. Yeah, terrific profanity. And then you get De Niro with his own patented brand of New York, you know, inserting fuck in every sixth word kind of thing. Yeah. But I love, there's a couple of good, my favorite profanity has always been someone shouting, "God damn it." And there's a couple of good ones of that here too. John Ashton has a good, like, just like, "God damn it." Like, I just There's a rhythm to that.
Great in this movie.
When John Ashton is insulting the cops while he's handcuffed to the car is my favorite. It's one of my favorite scenes. The staging, everything about it. I'm like, a guy who is clearly needing help and just abusing the living daylights out of him. I'm like, I can't get enough. I'm afraid now, Jen, Brian, and Clay, to watch this movie at night when I want to go to sleep, because mm-hmm. it's my worst nightmare, because I'm having so much fun being immersed in it that I think, oh, just the score will make me, you know, like relax and maybe, you know, just.
Oh, no, you start this movie.
Blake, are you insane? Yeah. No. Why would you think this score would make you relax? This
is jaunty.
You fucking like run around and.
Yeah. No, but it's so comforting. It's so comforting. But then
you get, it is comforting, you can't fall asleep. You'll watch the whole movie.
I watched the goddamn whole movie.
You gotta start grooving when this score comes on.
Every time.
The score is another. Yeah. The score is another MVP for sure. Elfman's score, like in terms of
it's so good,
punching those comedic beats, like maybe making a beat, doing what a good score in a comedy should do, where sometimes it informs you this is supposed to be funny or not. Like it's so well used, and it's such an unusual score from him. I mean, it's so different.
It doesn't sound me. Yeah, I mean, once he started doing, once he started doing superhero movies, the Elfman stuff kind of. His style sort of
there's that style and then there's there's the Burton Elfman thing with the la 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 that I love.
What I love about this score and what was interesting about hiring Elfman, who was a pop musician, to do the score, and it's a little bit like, you know, they were having, you know, Tangerine Dream and people goblin do scores at this time, is it feels like the music. It feels like the guy playing the music is kind of a character in the, you're like 100%. Listening to him watch the movie and he's playing his thing, and it's not different pieces and different for different moods or different. It feels like one consistent, this guy's just playing and then it gets set. And he's like, it takes it, you know, it goes like a minor, you know, it just, it's.
And the little piano riff.
All the same style, all the same piece. And just it goes up when the movie goes up and it goes down when the movie goes down. And when he does his concerts, does he play Midnight Run?
I don't know.
I went to one of his concerts.
I don't know.
I know he
there
tours.
Is a song. There is a
last
song
summer
with
he
lyrics.
Toured? Oh, yeah. There is a song with lyrics. And that plays at like the end.
It
the
never
credits?
Plays in the movie. They never made plays it for, in the movie. They made it for the end credits and they didn't use it. And then you can get it on, I think it's on like the special edition soundtrack. Mm-hmm. This is where Alan Sepinwall, our friend and I, disagree. I think it was a very, very smart choice
not to
use the lyrics. I don't want to know the lyrics. Alan quite likes the song. But
why are you so unpopular with the Chicago Police Department?
Well, if only. No. I just it doesn't need lyrics. I love what you said, Clay. You're right. It's like maybe more than any movie I can think of. It's like somebody, it's like the score is watching the movie with you and reacting.
It's the narrator. It's so cool.
It's like a narrator. It's so it's interesting.
Yeah, like John Lurie's Get Shorty score, another Farina for Mark Mothersbaugh's stuff Wes Anderson.
For Wes Anderson. I think that's a great comp. Yeah, where you feel like a friend is there watching it with you and kind of underlying the emotion. Because that is again that scene at the house with the little girl. The scoring, that little do 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 do, that sort of mournful little piano trill when she's standing there in front of the house. That's another thing that this movie doesn't get enough credit for. It's a beautifully composed, beautifully shot movie. I just watched the Shout Factory 4K they just put out.
Beautiful.
And I don't have you seen it? Yeah.
Yeah,
I've not seen the 4K.
It really drives home just how beautifully photographed this thing is and what purposeful and brilliant art direction there is. You know, you sort of take for granted an 80s comedy that's on the road using real locations. Those are as art directed as any movie.
Yes,
and just those shots of that wonderful
not now
but back then that wonderful shot establishing the bail bonds row that kind of pans down from the drops drifts down and you see all the neon signs bail bonds and then you pick up Jack, you know, coming in.
And then they go to Grand gorgeous. Central Market, which I just like, he's like, it's like for a quick exposition scene, let's go fucking to Grand Central Market and and just the production headache that would go into that when nowadays they would be like, this is a one page scene of exposition. Why can't we just tack it onto the
to the same
scene in the office. Like it breaks up the sequence. It makes it feel less like a, okay, this is an exposition scene, even though it is a continuing exposition scene. You put it somewhere where there's hustle and bustle and things to look at. And that's a great spot there.
Yeah. Fantastic.
Perched at that corner at Grand Central Market with just like rows of neon signs and shoppers and things milling around. And it's like, you don't need to do it, but it's visually interesting. It re-energizes that sequence of exposition, and it creates like a sense of place. And it's just, you know, that's the kind of thing where you look at it as a line item on a budget and you're like, it's a company move. We have to like, you know, probably shoot this at 3 a.m. You got to bring in extras. We got to do all this stuff. And it's a huge space. We're going to have to light it. And all. And then that's the thing they just used to do.
Yeah.
They didn't used to balk at that. They'd be like, oh, this is what making movies is.
Right. And now you're absolutely right. And it also pays off narratively because later on when he finds out the phone's
Joey Pants
tapped,
has to run back,
get over to the Chinese restaurant. Yeah. You can get there quick. They won't be able to run a trace. So yeah, it establishes just sort of the world these guys are in. And just the, and throughout the movie, just the little nothing Indian reservation town with the plane, the house where his wife and the new police captain live, and the daughter, like every little location that they find themselves in, is just so beautifully presented. And there's a lot of really gorgeously composed shots throughout that you kind of just miss when you should miss because you're along for the ride. Like nothing about this movie draws attention to itself, which is why it's so good
and why it works.
And it's probably why I don't know if I would call it an underrated movie, because I think it's got a real following and people love it, but it doesn't necessarily
underseen.
By
people my age and young, this generation, like the middle to the like younger millennials,
probably don't even know about it.
I'm sure Gen Z has no idea what this movie is. They've never heard of it. They have no interest in it. But I love it. It's that's so great about 80s movies is just this middle point between the 70s and like this is the middle point between Scarecrow and Bad Boys. It's got just enough of that 70s grit and realism and whatever to really feel grounded and make you really, really invested. And then it's on its way. It's got the pace is snappier. It's not like this movie. This movie has a helicopter exploding. Like it's got it is taking these kind of this like 70s sensibility with actors who aren't comedians. At some point, no actor who isn't a stand-up or an SNL cast member was allowed to be in a comedy.
That's true.
These are guys who are actors. Even Grodin, I always forget. I was like, Grodin was like a comedian. No, he's just an actor. Like,
classically trained actor. He's a stage actor. Yeah.
He was an actor. Same thing with like Gene Wilder, not a comedian, just like an actor. This is the midpoint between the 70s version of this, which would have had, love 70s movies, would have had sequences that
Scarecrow, which is like, oh God.
Would have been Scarecrow, a little slow, a little meandering, a little bit ponderous, and great for what it is, but not thrilling.
No.
You pump up the like pace of the edit, you pump up how many scenes there are, how many locations, you blow up a plane, you get some action, you get some, you know, car chases. And then this is on the way to Bay into what we have now, which I love as well. But I think this is such a great, this is probably my favorite version of the timeline of this kind of movie. I think this is where it was at its finest.
And also, somehow, it's an 80s movie that has all these elements that manages to not be racist or misogynist.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's incredible in that regard.
It's timeless. Yeah. It really isn't. There's no... It's a very diverse cast too.
Yeah.
For its time, but you know, there's no, and like I'm not a prude about this stuff, but like a lot of the other movies we reference, like 48 Hours or Beverly Hills Cop or whatever, like there's stuff that doesn't.
Yeah.
Well, those movies.
There's nothing in this that doesn't play now.
To be fair, those movies are. Race is kind of part of.
It's about race.
Well, sure, and I love both of those movies. I love 48 Hours, you know, and it makes sense. But
even like I don't remember. I mean, I love Lethal Weapon. I can't remember.
Homophobia. Yeah, like, there's none of that in this.
Well, so, like this one, you're expecting Farina to say
a word that he doesn't say,
like even in passing. But there's nothing.
He doesn't. It's but it's still got a hard edge. You know, it still feels like these, as you say, these characters feel authentic, and the violence, while not R-rated, feels like, you know, proper violence. And did you know Marvin was supposed to die?
Oh, really?
Yeah, wow. I forgot to mention that earlier. Marvin, in the scene where Marvin shows the mobsters,
yeah, they're gonna kill him.
Thing, they were supposed to blow his brains out. Oh. And at some point during shooting, and I wish I could. There's a lot of really good. If for all you listening who are fans of this movie, if you don't have the Shout Factory DVD or the Blu-ray, it's got a lot of great extra features. It's got fairly recent interviews with pretty much everybody involved. Not Grodin, but well, maybe they're, I don't remember. But anyway, somebody, I think it's Gallo, who says that they were shooting the movie, and I don't remember if it was, I wish I could remember, but somebody involved with the production, whether it be Ashton or Brest or Gallo, one of them was like, we can't kill Marvin. Yeah. So if we kill him, the movie's a bummer.
It won't work.
They'll just be upset. Like, I think they were noticing how good and how endearing he is, even though he's such a piece of shit. They also weren't sure how to end the movie.
Mm. Okay.
That last scene, the Clay reference that is so brilliant, came as they were shooting. It was like, how do we wrap this up? And not killing Marvin unlocked it.
Yeah. Yep.
Because him showing up is what ratchets up the ending.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I'm so glad they didn't do that, because whoever made that determination was absolutely right. It was just wrong for this, you know, for the tone they'd set, you know. Well, that's so funny, where he has the picture of him with the name of the hotel and the towels. he's so pleased. He's so pleased with himself.
This has been Midnight Run Through with Blake Howard and Jen Johans. We'll be back next week with another episode. But until then,
see you in the next life. See you in the next life.